Museum of the Moving Image welcomes you to the Pinewood Dialogues Online, an archive of conversations with innovative creative figures in film, television, and digital media. Visit Museum of the Moving Image in New York City or online at www.movingimage.us.
Please welcome Philip Glass. And please welcome back Godfrey Reggio. And John Kane. And I'm so glad we finally have Steven Soderbergh here. We've always wanted him here, but he's always working on something. And he could have been at the Golden Globe ceremony tonight because behind the Michael Douglas and Matt Damon and Rob Lowe are all up for Golden Globes tonight, but he is with us here in Astoria, so we're appreciative. And I guess I'll start with you as a sort of representative of the audience because you're presenting this film.
And yeah, I didn't do anything.
you watched it.
Yeah, and some offered encouragement. Godfrey and I had worked. I had a little more involvement in Nakoi Katsi, so we had stayed in touch. But I was very excited by this. One of the things I'm sure will come up is the way in which Godfrey seems to rebuild his aesthetic with each film. They're all so completely different. And I was excited for him when I saw the film because I felt he'd really taken a leap into another territory. So it was really kind of a luxury to be associated with it at all.
So I guess the question is I was curious about something you said in the beginning before the film, which I think is really true. You call this an experiential film.
Right.
And you were saying that you didn't want it labeled an experimental film. Right. But in a way, it's an experiment in the sense that you are trying something totally new. It's an experiment for you and for the audience. But I'm just wondering if you could talk about...
Well, it might be just... I don't like the word experiment because I think it has to do with science. Mm. It's something that's of the mind. You're trying to see this or work with that. And, of course, in a digital medium, that's more than possible to do if you don't have any idea. Oh, well, let's try this or let's try that, because all you got to do is press the button. The essence of the film is an experience. It's the audience. It's the experience of the audience. So... I also feel, as I said earlier, that this film... Well, I didn't say that. I was on the phone. This film is like a cine monad, if I can be so bold. It's beyond the conventional definitions of what is normally seen in cinema. Now, having said that, there are many other poetic cinema, but it doesn't usually get into the marketplace very often. These are attempts to not search for something, but to find something within yourself that you can midwife. So in that sense, I never considered it experimental, any of the films. It was always trying to make a form where the audience becomes at once the storyteller, the script, and the plot of the film.
Actually, thank you. John, I love the reading about how you got involved in working with Godfrey, because I guess it was as also an audience member, somebody who was working on your own, doing more commercial work, but you saw films. So could you talk about how you started to collaborate?
Well, I learned about Godfrey in college. I saw Koyaanis Kotsi as a freshman. I was a pre-law major at the time, and after I saw the film, I became a film major. So it kind of literally changed my life.
So one less lawyer in the world, thanks to you.
Yeah. Yeah. So literally the film changed the course of my life. And then many years later in 2000, I guess around 2000, My friend Ty Burr was writing an article in the Times about Nakoi Katsi, and Godfrey was trying to raise money for that film. And we're pushing our kids on the swing in the park and, you know, half asleep because we had toddlers. And Ty said, "You ever heard of a film called Koyaanisqatsi?" And I said, "Yeah, changed my life," told him the story. He said, "Oh," and he knew at the time I was a commercial director, you know, actively making TV commercials. He said, "You know, it'd be great to get a quote for the article about the influence of Koyaanisqatsi on pop culture generally and on commercial making and filmmaking and whatever it is and what, you know, what you're doing." So I gave him a quote about something having to do with how pictures and word pictures and music cut deeper and faster than words or something like that. I guess Godfrey read the quote, like, "Who's this guy?" And one thing led to another, and did some research, and we met, and that's how I got started on Nakoi Katsi editing.
And Philip, you are so associated now with Godfrey's films. Could you talk about your getting involved with this particular film? You know, what did you hear or know about it at first?
Well, there's usually years of discussion, partly because it takes so long to raise the money to make the movie. So to keep ourselves entertained in the meantime, I'm entertained because Godfrey likes to talk about what he's going to do. So the process of the film, in terms of the gestation of the ideas, it must be 4 or 5 years before we actually began, wouldn't you say, Godfrey? Maybe longer.
It was 9 years.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I've sometimes, in this case, I kept a lot of the records of these discussions. So when I was recently looking through, it was like an archaeological dig to get to what. But some of the images were from there from the very beginning. The very arresting image of the big chimpanzee.
Gorilla. Triska? From
the beginning.
From the beginning. Yeah, that particular one, we didn't meet that particular one until we got to the Bronx Zoo a couple of years ago. But that was always... Some of the ideas actually remain through the process. But a lot of other things start to change. And also, you have to remember, the technology is changing at the same time. So that's also impacting on what Godfrey is very... is very skillful in taking new technology and figuring out what to do with it. And so things were happening on that level that was new for us too.
Except his cell phone.
One of the things that Godfrey always says to me, and we've done how many, six movies now. Before each movie he says, "Nell, I want something completely different." But we start from there. And when I look back on the scores, they are quite different.
Yeah.
This one was a surprise. I didn't know when I finally began looking at the images in John's studio and Red Hook, it didn't take long. I think that I spent 2 or 3 days with some ideas, and by the third or fourth day, I was writing. Within 4 days, I was actually writing the music, which is very, very quick. But there we had the opportunity to look at, I would write the music, we'd quickly look and see how it was playing with the image. That's one of the ways that we work, that the music and the image making happens at the same time, which is unusual. We don't really get to do that in commercial movies very much.
Because you're usually looking at a film that's pretty much done? I mean,
almost always. In a few cases, it's not the case. Yeah. But almost always it's done that way. It's the way the film business works that way. So it's just like trying to put the horse in a different place and the car in a different... I mean, just to change that is extremely difficult. I've managed to do it a very, very few times. But with Godfrey, we work with image and music right away so that I become... But once we stop, we're out of the talking phase into the actual... production of shooting, and then I go to the film shoots too. I was down in Louisiana. I was in the boat in the swamp with Godfrey. That's an important part of it. I feel that when I have that's part of the experiential part. This is maybe talking about, but when I'm there when the film is being shot and I'm looking at the filmmaker, looking at the cinematographer, all that becomes part of the. That becomes a resource. Because I have very little resource with Godfrey's movies. They have been very different from each other.
And he wasn't just there on the nice days. There were the cold, rainy days, still hanging out. Philip, you can go inside.
It was raining on the swamp, John. It's okay. For the process of working with Godfrey has been an ongoing one. It began in 1978.
So could you talk about just some of the key decisions that were made, the use of black and white and the use of the black backgrounds? I mean, are these things you came to intuitively?
Well, Philip was talking about how the gorilla's image was from the beginning. There's another image. You'll all help me. I don't know the proper name for it, but there are two faces gazing at each other that together create a chalice. It was done in the very beginning of the 20th century. It was about double perception. Yeah. Okay. That was an indication more intuitive than intellectual about the reciprocal gaze that is inside of the film. Now, as far as black and white, it wasn't lockstep that we would be. We didn't shoot it, and we shot it in color because that's what the red camera does, but you can press the button, put it in black and white. We had quite a discussion in the studio, but my own feeling is the following, that if something is done in black and white, it immediately removes the subject from representation in the manner that we're used to seeing it. When you do something in color, it contemporizes the image. It brings it into the present in a very palpable and ordinary way. To do something in black and white can be much more emotive. Also, precognitively, before your mind starts working on this, when you see color, your eye is moving without you realizing it to create the unity that those various colors give you for the singularity of the image. When it's in black and white, and if it's on what I call a black ground, then there's the least amount of distraction. It can be most focused for the viewer, especially for a film like this. When you have the subjects of the film in direct narrative or dialogue with the audience, which is an original idea for the film, then it has to be something where there's the least distraction as possible. Now, those of you that are filmmakers know that it's kind of a, quote, mortal sin to have the actors look at the audience. Not that it's not done, there are exceptions, but as a main drive, it takes away the voyeuristic experience of you sitting here watching intimacy, blood, everything like through the keyhole. So, obviously, with the people facing you, it's clear that there's a narrative, hopefully, between you and the audience, and let's call that the reciprocal gaze.
Okay, and then your approach to editing is quite different than most films and your films, because I think it's well known by now. There's only there's less than 80 shots. It's like
74. But if you accept the idea that this is cinematic poetry. If you know about poetry, it's words that create the poem. But the essence of poetry is to use less than more and not have logic as the binder of what you're saying. This is pictorial composition. So it's very much what the images show you. They start speaking to you. And if you're attentive, I know this might sound ooga-mooga, they speak to you. They let you know how they can be cut. Our job as filmmakers is to, as it were, midwife that process.
So, Steve, actually, I'll put you on the spot, Stephen, and ask for you as a viewer of the film, what was your experience? Because Godfrey said it's a different experience for everyone. So I'm just curious how you...
Well, it's for the same reason it's fun to watch the Olympics. Seeing somebody do something that you could never do or never would do is always incredibly exhilarating. And I'd be curious to know, so how many shots didn't make it?
Well, there's 630,000 feet. A film of 100 minutes is 10,000. You do the math. That's over 60 films, okay?
Wow.
So obviously 9 out of 8 images didn't get in the film when we end up with 74 at the end of the day.
However, I mean, for example, there were many, many more portrait shot than we shot. But to Godfrey's credit and to talk about the fact that it's not an experimental film, there were very few categories of shots that we shot that we didn't use. Do you know what I'm saying? So with we didn't just shoot a bunch of stuff and then decide later. We went out to shoot specifically what we wanted. Within those categories, yeah, the ratio was very high, but very few things that we went out to shoot got, relative to how many are in the movie, got thrown away.
Could you talk?
Very efficient in the topic of the shots.
Could you talk about casting? I mean, how you found the people that you were filming, people and gorillas? I mean,
like,
a gorilla?
Well,
gorilla is from the Bronx. First of all, they're different kinds of gorillas. This is just an impression, but it's one that I made guiding the choice. My own opinion is that the lowland female gorilla, her face is most like human animals. I'm not saying their genetic structure, let's forget the science. I'm looking at it aesthetically. And I worked with, Philip and I worked with chimpanzees for another film or for another project in Fabrica in Italy. To work with a chimpanzee is extremely dangerous because they're extremely volatile. Not that I was right next to the gorilla. We were shooting through glass, but the gorilla is more sedentary. It's a more calm animal. So that was extremely important to get that gorilla, and that happened at the Bronx Zoo and through a contact that Philip had, an associate commissioner of Parks and Recreation, which the zoo it belongs, the land belongs to the city. Through that dear gentleman, Josh Laird, we were able to get access to shooting as long as we wanted for no money.
Hmm. And how about, the other subjects in the film? How did you go about?
Which one?
People, the people.
In the very beginning, again, how this gets realized becomes why I work with John and Philip, okay? But in the beginning, in the idea, it was about 2.5 primates in a pew. Now, you know who the 2.5 primates are. There's the gorilla, the human, and the cyborg. The gorilla, in this case, dramatically, is the adult in the room. She's the one that's conscious in terms of this film. Humans are swinging by their tails from the trees. We're the real King Kong. And those are represented in some portraits in the beginning. And then cyborgs, you and me and everyone else and all of us on the stage, are those that are not the cyborgs of science fiction, but of the fiction of science. By virtue of us becoming the technological environment we live in, we are all, at least from the point of view of this film, cyborg. So those predicated the three kinds of portraits that you see in the film.
You you have such clear ideas about what you're going after. I'm wondering how that plays into your collaboration with music. Do you give, I mean...
Well, there's a lot of listening that goes on. But I think this happened that you've heard Godfrey speak for a few minutes now. So figure you do this for 9 years.
And we might do that today. Yeah.
Well, you might
start it.
But it's very Godfrey likes to call it a dialogue. I call it listening to Godfrey. But
and my job is to listen to Godfrey and then figure out how to turn it into pictures.
But you know,
so that just boils it down pretty much.
The magic of talking to Godfrey is that he helps you to create an engine of let's say invention that will be necessary. Because what he's talking about is almost certainly something you haven't seen before in a movie. He's always managed to step out past the last frame of the last picture into something new. And that's happened for every one we've done. See, there are 6 of them now. And those fairly long periods of time, Godfrey is not based in New York, but he comes in a lot. And the contact is pretty continuous throughout. I think that that's a process which has worked well for me. I don't know how, John, has it worked for you?
Well, Godfrey lived in Red Hook for pretty much the whole 2 years. I mean, 18 months for sure straight. And we met family style every day at the studio. Mm. The bell got rung at 10 in the morning. We had our meeting. And really, what Godfrey would call, we were marinating in the tank together to create this film. This isn't the kind of thing where there's a storyboard and we have a meeting and then someone does something over there. We do, you know, work all together every day, all day, for a long time to create the language that we're trying to find in the darkness.
You know, we're to work on this kind of work, you need a kind of engine of change for yourself. Because normally what you've done in the past is not going to work. You know, that worked for something else. So what we find, one of the things that's inspiring to do this kind of work where it's really finding its way, it's defining itself as it goes along, and at a certain point we collectively begin to see together what it is that we're trying to do. And I think we're pretty much on a similar place. But that works contrary to the way commercial films are done. They were making films, and I've done a lot of that too. And that's not a bad way to work either. I've enjoyed a lot of that kind of work. But you're working within a kind of a known give and take environment. And that's something that can be very joyful and exciting too. But when we're working this way, whatever you learn making movies is not going to be much help, right?
Well, Stephen can certainly speak to that, the difference between our creative process and the process of making a traditional film.
Well, it's all, you know, it's problem solving, ultimately, no matter what you're doing. And often my experience has been that the process begins by determining what you don't want to do, and that begins to start a conversation. So what I was coming in and witnessing the end of seemed very familiar to me in terms of the collaboration going on. The result wasn't familiar, but I felt like the dialogue felt right in line, at least with my experience.
Okay. I'd like to open it up to the audience to take some questions. We could bring up the house lights a bit. Does the guy who flew here from Minneapolis have a question? We could start. He should get the first question if he has
one. Did he get in?
Or maybe I had to go back to the airport. I don't know. Oh, go ahead.
Well, let somebody go. I'll take
When's your flight back? Okay, let's start over here.
Two-part question. Godfrey, thank you for your service to cinema. Your Cossi films all had a guiding principle, life out of order, life as war. For visitors, is there something similar, perhaps, to that?
Did you have an overall guiding principle?
And the second question would be for Stephen. You had mentioned that this is something that you wouldn't or couldn't do as a filmmaker. And having been very vocal about retiring from directing and producing now, do you feel like you're, as Godfrey said, a midwife to other people's creative vision?
Go ahead.
Okay.
Gee whiz, how do I answer your question? What was the question?
Well, if there was an overall, if you had like an overall guiding principle in mind while you were going through this.
You know, that not so much in my mind. I mean, I don't want to, again, sound like I've taken leave of my senses, but it's something more intuitive, okay? It's something that there's a voice within us all, and to be able to shut out distraction and hear it with the commitment not of grace and gratuity, but like to an insane asylum, is what my task is. Having said that, I'll try to be a little more specific. All the films, especially, Philip and I have been doing these films for well over 35 years now, and all of them, in terms of the subject matter, not how they treated what people might think about them once they're finished, but in terms of what it took to put it together, deals with technology in some way. I don't mean technology that's limited to the ubiquitous gadgets that all of you have in your hands right now. I mean technology as a new and comprehensive host of life, replacing the physical environment in which we live. Being human beings, we become the environments we live in. And that's why I can say boldly that we are now cyborged, because we are becoming the technology that we're in. It is as ubiquitous as the air we breathe. So that's been, if you want to look at it by abstraction, the abstract or the intellectual part of it, each one of these films, it's been like churning butter or going around the tree. Or if you're a martial artist or a person with movement, the motion you have in the first move is not the same that you have in move 10,000. So we've been, Philip and I, at least for 30-something years, have been really on this. As Philip said, even though I've only been able to make films because it's very hard to get anybody to invest in them, I have to have angels willing to make a bad deal for love of the project. But all during that time, I'm going to Philip's home in New York because all the angels are here, or many of them, sleeping on his kitchen floor, being received as a family member, and it makes it all possible. So I'm very, very fortunate.
Yeah, and the question for Stephen, who I would hardly call a retired director, he's making a big project right now, but if you have an interest in bringing other films to light, I guess that's what you're asking. Called you a midwife, but you also were involved in a restoration of a great movie called End of the Road on Blu-ray, a sort of unknown, really important independent film from the 60s.
Yeah, I mean, I've stopped formally pursuing producing projects, but things come up in a serendipitous way that it's fun to help along with. But, you know, one of the reasons it's fun to hang out with this group is to sort of get a bit of a contact high of what a process that is sort of uncompromised feels like. And part of the reason that I took a step away from movies for a while is because, you know, when I talk about how Godfrey sort of rebuilds his aesthetic with each project, this idea of wanting to not repeat yourself is more difficult in the mainstream cinema world because the box is a lot smaller. So you have to look for ways to push yourself into a different territory. In the case of the thing that we're working on now, and I believe that you guys can talk about this. There has to be a fear quotient to keep you alert. At least I need that. Something about it needs to terrify me, or it's not worth. Then you might as well just, you know, direct it from your home. And so I've found lately that at least television is providing more creative opportunities to do things that are, you know, not down the middle. So, but as I said, it's fun to the process that they all go through individually and collectively to make sure that the piece is unified, that all of the elements are unified, and that the result is organic and will withstand the test of time. It's fun to be around that. It's a good reminder. Sometimes you can, if you're on a sort of typical project, the sensation can be sort of like standing in the exhaust of a jet engine. And so it's nice to go. It was nice to go over to Red Hook and sort of dip into that. I probably got more out of it than they did.
Did you feel like fear at any point? Like just saying like what? Yeah.
As he said, all the time. All the time. I mean, I get very excited to do it, but I'm always a little fearful that, gee, how's the music going to turn out? I haven't heard what Philip did yet. When he writes the music is when I get the most fear. Not that I don't trust him. It's just something inside. I mean, because his music is beyond consequential for this. And unlike the edit and the collaboration I do with John, and which is something I could talk about for a long time, all I can do, as Philip said, is try to pump him up. But it's he that has to write the music. It's not us that write the music. He writes it. So it makes me, I get so nervous. Also, because I'm naive. Whenever it goes out live, I think that they'll never keep it together. But Michael Riesman is a genius. He never misses the guy who conducts the live performances.
But meanwhile, creatively, when we're making the film, you are basically, you know, I would fearless, but also like devoid of fear in a way. I mean, making a movie like this, if you come from, you know, planet Earth of commercial filmmaking, is, you know, yeah, there's a lot. We're really out pushing out the boundaries a lot. So Godfrey wasn't fearful in the same way that I don't think that that Steven's talking about, or that I felt making the film, which is, you know, we're trying to make up a new language from, you know, five sounds and talk about, you know, life on Earth. So yeah, that it's a reason that we all, you know, gather around Godfrey as we get to, you know, go down a creative path like that, that you don't really get to do that often.
Yeah, but I'll make it quick. You know the statement, leap and the net will appear. Okay, now if that's not a metaphor, and if it's reality, think of if you might be fearful to take that leap. And of course you are, because without it, you wouldn't be, you might be spaced out of your mind. So it takes fear to do this as well.
Does this, Philip, does this apply to you? I'm interested, because you were talking a bit about wanting to do something that's different. I mean, this film, this score is recognizably yours. Nobody would mistake for a moment that it's a Philip Glass score, but it is very
okay,
different.
What I have to do is to take all of these ideas, which are precise and amorphous at the same time,
right. And
the only way I can work with it is to interpret it through the language of music. Now, that, for many of us, is abstract, but for some of us, it isn't abstract. But basically, I have to get off the chessboard that I've been on and find another board. The language of music for the musician, it's an all-powerful and embracing world. And I'm on that perch, so it's a bit different. What Stephen said about the fear, you know, I think that this is, in the end, for any of us, it'll be an exercise in communication. And what Godfrey has done in this film, which is so interesting, has switched it around from making the spectator not being the recipient, but being the active creator of the work. That's how it looks to me. And so I can relate to those things. But then how does that work in the music? There's no book I can look it up in. I'm working on by the seat of my pants, and fortunately, I've been involved with the language of music as long as I can remember. But I have to go back to that source, which may seem abstract, but is actually the only comfort I have is what command I have of that language.
Yeah, we just have time. Well, unfortunately, we just have time.
We only took one question.
I know, we do have another film showing. I do want to say, I know that actually Stephen has to go in just a few moments, something else, so I don't. We'll go for a few more minutes, but we'll start. I guess let's go in the middle here.
I do take a question from somebody who didn't have the benefit of seeing Crayon Scotsky before becoming a lawyer. And so I wanted to observe that the statement that you make in the excerpt from the epistle that's distributed here, you say, our language no longer describes the world in which we live. And especially in the theme of language that you've been discussing, I have to suppose that this has some relation to this film and to your work in general. And I wondered if you'd care to say something more about that.
Okay, quickly. Yeah. Yes, I believe it's tragic. I don't believe our language any longer describes the world we live in. I think our language is describing an artifact or an ancient world that's no longer present. Try to wrap your head around that. The world, the language that the world speaks, the global world, is a digital language. It's a language of image, an iconic language. It's a language that must be seen. So it's not for any lack of love of language that these films don't have language. It's that I felt they would limit what the affect of the film could be. Hence, for the Kotze films, names that are given that have no analog in your experience, Koyanis Kotze, Poa Kotze, Nakoi Kotze, deliberately chosen from non-spoken languages, illiterate languages, that in my opinion have more insight or perspicacity into the world in which we live than the languages that we speak.
Okay, over here.
Part of that abstract form of communication seems to exist within the pairing of the music with the image, and when the music stops in comparison to the image. And I was wondering if that was a collaborative decision to decide at which point the phrases would kind of come to a conclusion and start again, or if that was
Did you collaborate on deciding when the music would stop and start? Like what places, how the music is placed?
Well, I don't know.
Well, Philip said something that a while back that really describes both the process of how that happens, and I think one of the key ways that the film is attempting to work on the audience, and that the music is in one place and the image is in another, and there's a space in between. And the viewer makes the journey between the music and the image in your mind. I mean, that happens all the time. Everybody's had the experience of being on the train with your headphone on. You look outside, and all of a sudden, you know, my life's a music video, and I feel very emotional.
Thank you, John.
Whatever.
Thank you for remembering. Thank you. That's a very powerful image. But the one thing I wanted to say is that this journey is extremely precise. The distance we are from the image can be almost measured.
Yeah, absolutely, but there's a gap there, and in the making of the music and the editing and creation of the images, there's also a gap because we're doing two different things. Making music and making pictures are different, well, but they dance together.
We
in
spend
a, way.
A lot of time in the studio looking at the picture together.
Right,
we look at it all the time, all from the first. For the first time, we have music. From that moment on, we're over there all the time looking and listening at the same time.
So that language of when things stop and when things do this or that, that's something that we're doing together almost like a dance. And you can't, if you pin it down, I mean, you can pin it down. We pin it down. We do television commercials and things that are much more, less poetic than this. But there's always that play between the two things, and we work to. That's part of the craft and the artistry of putting the film together is deciding, based on what we have before us, how to react.
Just a specific answer. I know we're getting close to the end when Garvey says we're close to the final cut. Now that means that the music staff is waiting to pounce on whatever is done, because we have to adjust to whatever is happening in Greenpoint. So Red Hook, because close to Greenpoint.
It's close. They're both in Brooklyn. Okay, we're in Queens Brooklyn right now.
There's a moment, let's say, of unease when we feel the music people think we're done, but they're not done. No, we're not done till they're done. So
and vice versa.
Exactly. But on the other hand. That's why Godfrey's the director, because he tells us when it's done.
It's kind of a fight, in other words.
Well, not exactly, but we're ready.
I'm sorry.
We're ready to make those adjustments as we have to.
We'll take a few more, but I do want to thank Stephen. I know he's busy with one of his post-retirement projects now, but I know he's they're waiting in the wings to take him away to that his next appointment. But so I want to thank Stephen, and then we'll stay here for a few more minutes. But thank you so much.
All right, thanks.
Okay. Off to enjoy his retirement. So okay, but go ahead, right down here.
Well, and I assume that the next step is when you're with the orchestra and you're there trying to figure out rendering your score.
That My music director has been with me since the early 70s, and Michael Reisman is extremely skillful in that regard. So he is involved with the not with the we make demo tapes that they work with, but from his looking at the music right away. And when we had to choose a conductor for the live performances, I urged and succeeded in getting urged Michael to be that person. He doesn't have to be that person forever, but he can set. But he will be the person, and that's a very good point. There's an interpretive moment. There's a moment that's left, which is not finalized, which is when the conductor conducts. And we've learned to trust him. We've known him a long time, almost from the beginning of our working together. And he has a very good read on the music. He knows the music very well. It may not be the final version of it. One of the wonderful things about these live performances is that when you bring the live component, the live performer interacting with the film, it's no longer a pre-ordered, a pre-existing piece. It's not going to be completed, really, until that evening, until the conductor's finished his work. That's why we've been pushing, and Godfrey's always wanted the live things. We do quite a lot, actually. Live, we do live performances with all the films. But one of the reasons to do that is that when we interface the live performer with the existing film, the whole dynamic has been changed. And you are then, as a spectator, you are watching it actually at the moment of creativity, the very moment. And I do not underestimate the creativity of the interpretive artist, which is a powerful element.
Well, there was another phase of that too, from the demo phase of the music to the actual soundtrack that you heard today, which is the Bruckner Orchestra in Austria. So there, going from the demo to the actual musicians playing the score, there was what Godfrey and I called the sort of adding the color. Like, we did color correction to the image, the music got color corrected in a way, and the emotion and the feeling of the music changed a lot in the process of recording the soundtrack that you hear.
But by the way, from the beginning, I knew that would be the orchestra we would use. I chose that orchestra because of the sound of the orchestra. But these guys had to have believed me. I said, look, that's where we have to go. And when they heard the orchestra, they said, yeah, that's right. But I knew it from my experience working with orchestras. Normally, I would have said I want an American orchestra because I always felt the American orchestras would know the music better. But in this case, I found the European orchestra could go deeper into the, in terms of depth and quality of the sound.
And Dennis.
I felt that they would go further than the, I have to put it that way, but I'm always choosing between the American orchestras and the European orchestras and which ones I'm going to go to. And for this one, I said, we have to go to the best Austrian orchestra we can find. It happened to be this orchestra. And the conductor happened to be someone I know. And I've worked with them before. We were able to make a reasonable arrangement with them financially, and we were able to do it. But these guys packed up and went. They had to go to Austria and make the recording. By the way, I was that confident of the result that I didn't go. I stayed home.
Okay. Wait, I think we promised Minnesota guy a question. So you ready?
I can tell you this, that the editor, Chris Baseka, who was so devoted to this, he and some other people with John, and I asked them please to make the fades as long as humanly possible. Now, that's very hard to do. John and Chris and his crew were able to do that. I never thought about the afterburn, but I can tell you this, that if I get light in my eyes and close them, I still see the light in my eyes. So I thank you for the comment.
Well, there was a specific way that the fades in the film weren't done just as dissolves to black. We did the fades in the color correction process, so the image doesn't fade out evenly in order for it to have this kind of lingering, almost like a visual echo in a way, without the steps. So there was some color correction, almost like if you were to turn off the lights on a thing, but not, you know, like the key light first and then the edge lights. We sort of did that kind of fade in when the color correction to give that kind of smooth, you know, kind of fade to black that you're talking about.
Okay. We unfortunately just have time for one more question here. You in the white shirt, you've been waiting. What were your subjects looking at?
Okay, well, there were three subjects. The gorilla was looking at the camera, remarkably. It took a while for that to happen, but when she started looking, the shot actually lasted just under 20 minutes.
Wow.
She was looking right at our camera, et cetera. The first portrait you saw, people were looking at nothing but the lens. The idea is never to have, we use only extras, okay? And the direction for the extra is that they not act. That sounds ridiculous. Try to figure it out. We only wanted them to do exactly what they normally do anyway. People know how to look at a lens. The other portraits of the little children watching TV, the gamers, the sports bar, they all knew they were being filmed. But as soon as that gizmo comes on, it's like a tractor beam. You go right out of self-consciousness. And we had so many people to take shots with that you're no longer aware. You knew the camera was behind the thing they were looking through, but you lose consciousness of it because of the technology involved. So nobody here was a conscious actor. Everybody was a non-self-conscious player. For this,
movies and video games, and sports,
TV and sports,
and the Final Four basketball tournament,
right.
Exactly, okay. To be exact, through a special two-way lens. So they didn't see the camera; they only saw what they were looking at.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, we have to stop. We do have another film at 5:00. I recommend you coming back for that. I think we might have a few minutes to just meet you out in the lobby to say hi. But I just want to thank you for an extraordinary screening.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, David.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening. The Pinewood Dialogues at Museum of the Moving Image are made possible by generous support from the Pannonia Foundation. To learn more about the museum, visit www.movingimage.us.